This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, everyone. This is Tracy Shoster, and today I'll be reading from the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times for Sunday, May 12th, 2024. Our first article for today, book bans are surging in Florida. So Lauren Groff opened a bookstore. It's called The Lynx, after the wildcat native to the state. We wanted something a little fierce, she said. On a recent Sunday, Lauren Groff got out of bed at 3 a.m, jolted by a mix of anxiety and adrenaline. It was opening day for The Lynx, Groff's new bookstore in Gainesville, Florida, and her mind raced with all that could go wrong. So she drove over to the store, where she felt reassured by the presence of some 7,000 books, a collection she had helped to curate. I like being there alone because I'm surrounded by all of my friends, Groff, a best-selling novelist and 3-time National Book Award finalist, said of the books. A few hours later, she was no longer alone. By 10 a.m., about 100 people had lined up outside the store to watch as Groff cut the ribbon. More than 3,000 people showed up throughout the day for a series of author readings, folk music, live poetry composition, and of course, to buy books. Groff and her husband, Clay Kalman, had toyed with the idea of opening a bookstore in Gainesville for more than a decade, but the timing never felt right. Groff's writing career was taking off, and they had 2 young sons. But last year, as book bans surged across Florida, they decided that their town needed an independent bookstore where titles that had been purged from libraries and classrooms would be on prominent display. This store would probably still be a pipe dream if the book bans hadn't happened, said Groff, who has lived in Gainesville since 2006. I want this for me, too. I don't want to live in a place where we stifle free expression. Last fall, they found an old building, a 2,300-square-foot former hair salon on South Main Street in downtown Gainesville. They transformed it into a bookstore and event space with a cozy reading nook in the children's book section, a small cafe, and large rolling display tables that can be wheeled away to make way for chairs. For the front of the building, they commissioned a 60-foot-long mural of a lynx, a wildcat native to Florida, sitting sphinx-like next to the store's motto, "Watch us bite back." We wanted something a little fierce, Groff said. Banned titles are prominently placed at the Lynx. A large display near the front of the store features frequently challenged books across the United States, among them The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, Beloved by Toni Morrison, Tricks by Ellen Hopkins, and All Boys Aren't Blue by George M. Johnson. Groff also hopes to make the Lynx a place where people will come together to discuss books that are being targeted. Upcoming selections for its banned books book club include Genderqueer by Maya Kobabe and Flamer by Mike Curato. The store's mission is also resonating outside of Florida. Since the Lynx opened, it has received about $1,000 in donations from around the country. Groff plans to use the funds to distribute free copies of banned titles to Florida residents who might not otherwise have access to them. At a time when we in Florida need to speak out against the banning of books and against the restriction of reading, she's going to have a real impact, said Mitchell Kaplan, the founder of Books and Books, an independent chain in South Florida, who shared advice with Groff when she was preparing to open the store. Groff is the latest writer to try her hand at bookselling, joining Ann Patchett, Louise Edrich, Judy Blume, Emma Straub, Jenny Lawson, Leah Johnson, Jeff Kinney, and others. This January, Groff attended the Winter Institute, an annual gathering of independent bookstore owners, where she got advice from more seasoned booksellers like Straub and Patchett. Straub said she urged Groff to focus not just on the fun parts of running a bookstore, like effusing over books with customers, but also the practical elements, like learning how to manage the point-of-sales system. A lot of us authors don't spend that much time thinking about that part. We think about the books and the community, all of that big picture stuff. And we don't necessarily think about the nuts and bolts retailness of it, Straub said. Like, oh, by the way, you need a mop. With its focus on banned books and Florida-centric literature, the Lynx could help make Gainesville more of a literary destination, a hub for author readings, book club gatherings, and workshops. For some local authors, the Lynx already feels like an oasis of sorts. This place is not only very welcome, but necessary, said Amy Hempel, a fiction writer who lives in Gainesville, and gave a reading on the store's opening day. As did the Florida authors David Leavitt, Rebecca Renner, Cynthia Barnett, and Kristen Arnett. The Lynx not only provides a gathering spot for book lovers, Hempel said, but also offers hope to residents who have been discouraged by book bans happening across the state. More than 5,100 books were banned in Florida schools from July 2021 through December 2023, the highest number in the country, according to PEN America. The signal it sends to a community, to the whole state, to the country at a really heated, difficult time is such a positive, Hempel said. Gainesville isn't exactly a book desert. It is home to the University of Florida and has a Books a Million and a new Barnes & Noble, but it has lost many of its independent shops. One of its beloved bookstores, Gerning's, went out of business in 2010, and another longtime independent, the Florida Bookstore, which was opened by Galman's grandfather in 1933, closed in 2016. Gainesville has great potential to have a literary community, but we needed a bookstore, said Alyssa Etherly, a Gainesville resident who stopped by the Lynx on a recent evening with her friend, Katie Dreffer, to pick up copies of books that were chosen for the store's romance book club. It's nice to have something that's not a big chain, Dreffer added. As more people trickled in, Groff greeted customers enthusiastically and asked if they needed recommendations or help finding a book. "Can I show you where the kids' section is?" she asked a little girl who came in with her mother. "What do you like?" The girl followed Groff to the children's area and asked for a book about ancient history. Groff asked another shopper who was scanning the display tables if she was able to find what she was looking for. "If you see spots we need to fill, let me know. I'm on it," she said. A big draw for the Lynx, for many readers and customers, of course, is Groff, an acclaimed writer. She has published 2 short story collections and 5 novels, among them her 2023 novel, The Vaster Wilds, about a girl who flees to the woods from a colonial settlement in the 1600s, and Matrix, her 2021 novel about nuns in medieval England. Part of the appeal of independent bookstores is their careful curation and booksellers' ability to recommend titles based on customers' interests and moods. Who better to help you choose your next book than a best-selling novelist who is also a voracious and wide-ranging reader? Next to the entrance, on a shelf full of bookseller recommendations, Groff placed a few of her own favorite novels with handwritten notes effusing about them, describing The Transit of Venus by Shirley Hazzard as a work of sheer genius, and calling Autobiography of Red by Anne Carson legit bonkers brilliant. Groff's husband, Calman, has only one recommended title on the shelf, Groff's novel, The Vaster Wilds, with a note that says, "It slays." Groff conceded that opening the store and meeting the demands of her own writing career has been exhausting, but she's not especially worried that selling other people's books will get in the way of writing her own. She often gets up at 5 a.m. to write and is working on 3 different novels. "I have 4 to 5 hours of writing, usually, if I'm not opening a bookstore," she said. She plans to be intimately involved in the store's operation, which will be overseen by the store's 3 booksellers and 2 managers. "I want to know how to do everything so that I can step in if I have to," she said. At the grand opening on April 28th, Groff was sweaty and frazzled, but buoyed by the enthusiasm of the store's hundreds of visitors. She got up on an outdoor stage and read from a short story titled Ghosts and Empties from her 2018 collection, Florida. Over the course of the day, the store sold 1,011 books, including 56 copies of Groff's, which sold out. The toilet clogged a few times, and some customers gave up because the cash register line was so long. But otherwise, the mood was celebratory. Not a single one of us had a breakdown, Groff said. Our next article for today, Cass Elliot's death spawned a horrible myth. She deserves better. The Mamas and the Papas singer was known for her wit, her voice, and her skill as a connector. For 50 years, a rumor has overshadowed her legacy. On stage with her group, the Mamas and the Papas, at the Monterey International Pop Festival in June 1967, Cass Elliot, the grand doyenne of the Laurel Canyon scene, bantered with the timing of a vaudeville comedian. "Somebody asked me today when I was going to have the baby." "That's funny," she said, rolling her eyes. The unspoken punchline, if you could call it that, was that she had already given birth to her daughter 6 weeks earlier. "One of the things that appeals to so many people about my mom is that there's a certain level of triumph over adversity," that daughter, Owen Elliott Kugel, said over lunch at the Sunset Marquee Hotel in Los Angeles on a recent afternoon. She had to prove herself over and over again. Elliott was a charismatic performer who exuded infectious joy and a magnificent vocalist with acting chops she did not live to fully explore. July 29th is the 50th anniversary of her untimely death at the age of 32, a tragedy that still spurs unanswerable questions. Might Elliott, who was one of Johnny Carson's most beloved substitutes, have become the first female late-night talk show host? Would she have achieved EGOT status? Half a century after her death, her underdog appeal continues to inspire. Last year, Make Your Own Kind of Music, a relatively minor 1969 solo hit that has nonetheless had cultural staying power, became such a sensation on TikTok that Saturday Night Live spoofed it in a hilariously over-the-top sketch in which the host, Emma Stone, plays a strangely clairvoyant record producer. "This song is gonna be everywhere, Mama," she tells Elliott, played by Chloe Trost. "Then everybody's going to forget about it for a long, long time, but in about 40, 50 years, I think it's going to start showing up in a bunch of movies, because it's a perfect song to go under a slow-mo montage where the main character snaps and goes on a rampage." SNL didn't make a single joke about Elliott's weight, something that was unthinkable half a century ago. During the height of her fame, Elliott seemed to co-sign some of the jabs at her expense with a shrugging grin. "No one's going to get fat except Mama Cass," the Mamas and the Papas sang in tight harmony on the self-mythologizing 1967 hit Creek Alley. After the infamously tumultuous group broke up a year later, Elliott was a frequent guest on the Carol Burnett Show, where she occasionally went for the cheap laugh. In an otherwise uproarious sketch about two prudish women browsing a store's dirty books section, Elliott holds up a book titled Eat and Lose Weight and says, "I got as far as eat, and then I didn't understand the rest." As she had learned early on, the best way to deal with an uncomfortable situation is with humor, Elliott Kugel, who has her mother's cascading hair and dry wit, writes in her new memoir, "My Mama Cass." But, as she said over lunch, that doesn't mean her mother was always laughing on the inside. "That pain had to go somewhere," Elliott Kugel told me. "When I think about some of the things that had allegedly been said to her during her lifetime, you can't hear that over and over and not let it hurt." But of course, the most enduring joke at her expense was the one she didn't live to tell or to rebut. "Have you heard the one about the ham sandwich?" For years, the origin of the story that Elliott died from choking on a ham sandwich, one of the cruelest and most persistent myths in rock and roll history, was largely unknown. Then in 2020, Elliot's friend, Sue Cameron, an entertainment journalist, admitted to publicizing it at her Hollywood Reporter obituary at the behest of Elliot's manager, Alan Carr, who did not want his client associated with drug use. Elliot died of a heart attack, likely brought on by years of substance abuse and crash dieting. But that cartoonish rumor, propagated in endless pop culture references from Austin Powers to Lost, cast a tawdry light over Elliot's legacy and still threatens to overshadow her mighty, underappreciated talent. Elliot's sister, Leah, coined a phrase for the strong, brassy way everyone in their family sang, the Cohen honk. Cass was born Ellen Naomi Cohen into a music-loving household in suburban Baltimore. Her stage name partly came from her father's penchant for calling her spirited laughter the Mad Cassandra. She was a precocious, uncommonly bright child who, in the years after World War II, liked to ask dinner guests what they thought about the world situation. In high school, she was known for her bold, slightly unkept personal style that flew in the face of 1950s decorum. According to her biographer, Eddie Fiegel, Elliot sometimes wore wild combinations of Bermuda shorts and high heels with white gloves to cover her bitten-down nails. Many people in Elliot's life trace her struggles with her weight to when she was six and went to stay with her grandparents while recovering from ringworm. They fed her well, as grandparents sometimes do, and she quickly became self-conscious about her size. By high school, she had been prescribed dexedrine, an amphetamine then used as an appetite suppressant. "The thought that something is wrong with you is bad enough," Elliot Kugel writes, "but the idea that a pill or a drug might fix you can even be more dangerous." Still, Elliot showed remarkable self-belief. The book recounts her telling anyone who would listen that one day she was going to become the most famous fat girl that ever lived. She struck a deal with her parents. If she moved to New York and didn't find musical success in 5 years, she would come home and study a more respectable field like medicine. She left home in late 1960. California Dreamin' was released in December 1965. She later told an interviewer, "I really just made it under the wire." Broadway was Elliot's first love, but folk music was the style of the day. She brought her own distinctive flair to it in her early groups, the Big Three, and then the Mugwumps, which featured a Canadian tenor named Denny Doherty. After the Mugwumps split, Doherty fled to the Virgin Islands with his new friends, John and Michelle Phillips, to work on material for a yet unnamed group. Elliot had sung with them casually while they were all hanging out, at least once while they were all on LSD, and she knew her voice was the missing piece in their sound. But John, the band leader, was brutishly reluctant. According to Scott G. Shea, a biographer of the Mamas and Papas, Phillips had a vision in his head of a group that not only sounded like an electrified Peter, Paul, and Mary, but also looked like them. Shea puts it bluntly, Michelle was to be the centerpiece, and in his mind, Cass was too fat to even be considered. The group projected a chumminess that was central to their appeal, but few people knew how hard Elliot had to push to become part of the band. She showed up unannounced in the Virgin Islands, hoping to ingratiate herself, but Phillips wouldn't budge until an act of fate intervened. While walking down the St. Thomas Alley that the Mamas and Papas would later immortalize in song, debris from a construction site hit Elliot on the head and knocked her unconscious. John Phillips would later claim that Elliot's concussion caused her vocal register to change, and it was another of those stories Elliot learned to repeat with a self-deprecating joke. "The real story is that John didn't like my mother's look," Elliot Kugel writes. She believes he made up the story about a fake increase in vocal range to justify his choice to finally add my mom to the band months later. Elliot went solo after the short-lived group's demise, buoyed by the success of Dream a Little Dream of Me, a Mamas and Papas single on which she sang lead. The final solo album she released in 1973 had a pointed title, Don't Call Me Mama Anymore. The moniker of Mama had always felt like a reference to her size, that is, Big Mama, and she hated that, Elliot Kugel writes. Elliot remains an underrated heroine in the story of the Laurel Canyon scene, not only as a musician, but also as an amiable hostess who knew how to link up like-minded people. Dougherty liked to call her the puppeteer. In 1964, she introduced her friends John Sebastian and Zal Yanofsky. They became the Lovin' Spoonful. When she heard that David Crosby and Stephen Stills had begun making music together, she suggested they add a high voice to the mix and brought them Graham Nash. "I will give you $100," David Crosby told Elliot's biographer, "if you can find a single person who says they hated Cass." But there was also something bittersweet about Elliot's kinship with all these men. "I think part of the reason they all adored her is they weren't threatened by her," Elliot Kugel said. "She knew more about these guys and had a relationship on a deeper level than some of their own wives or girlfriends had." She added, with a wry chuckle, "Did that mean she didn't want to jump into bed with half of them? She probably did." Elliot's unrequited love for her bandmate, Dougherty, was perhaps the hardest to bear, especially after he and Michelle Phillips had an affair that nearly broke up the band before their first album was even released. Elliot had been smitten since the night they met at a Greenwich Village bar where they each threatened to drink the other under the table, and eventually decided to drink under the table. As he put it in one of his one-man shows about the group's history, "I knew she loved me, and I loved her too, but not like she wanted me to. She did weigh 300 pounds, and I wasn't man enough to deal with that." The most difficult passages of My Mama, Cass, are those in which Elliot Kugel reckons with her mother's persistent loneliness. After the shows, when they were screaming her name on stage and she's bowing, "She was the only one going back to the hotel by herself," she said. "Everybody else had somebody, and she didn't." Elliot's need for love and companionship is what drove her to the decision, relatively radical for a famous woman in the late 1960s, to become a single mother. When she learned she was pregnant at the height of the group's success after a brief fling with its touring bassist, she was defiant in her decision to raise the child on her own. "As it turned out," Elliot Kugel writes, wrenchingly, "my mom's desire to have someone in her life who wasn't going to up and leave her was what led to her desire for a child. It's how I came to be." "When I finally got Sue Cameron on the phone, she was calling from the Atlantic Ocean, somewhere between Bermuda and Portugal. A journalist for more than 50 years, who has published a book titled Hollywood Secrets and Scandals, she sometimes gives lectures on cruise ships. She was happy to reminisce about her old pal. She had a big smile and this wide open face, very happy to see people," Cameron said. "You would just immediately love her and want her to be your best friend." Cameron met Elliot when she interviewed the Mamas and the Papas in 1966. They realized they were neighbors and quickly became sit-by-each-other's-pool kind of friends. Cameron has stories, like the one about the night they ran into Anne Margaret, and Elliot delivered the perfect one-liner about her massive engagement ring. "I could skate on that." Or all the times Elliot would walk around with a credit card in her shoe because she didn't like to carry a purse. Her most painful memory is her final dinner with Elliot at Mr. Chow in the summer of 1974, before Elliot left for London. She'd never seen her friends so happy. "It was just a magical moment," Cameron recalled. "It was just like the crescendo of her being." She'd had some TV specials. She was now going to go do a big nightclub act. Everything was fabulous. After a two-day stint of partying in London, Elliot told her friend Joe Croyle, a dancer in her show who was crashing with her at Harry Nilsson's pad, that she was going to take a bath and turn in early because she was exhausted. Croyle figured she would be hungry too, so he fixed her a sandwich with ham, the only thing he could find in the fridge, along with some Coca-Cola. The ham sandwich, the cruelly cartoonish symbol that would come to define Elliot, was actually a gesture of care, a friend making her a meal she never got to enjoy. Cameron heard about Elliot's death in the newsroom of the Hollywood Reporter, where she was working at the time. I kicked in to professional mode and said, "No one else is going to write that O bit. I'm going to do it." She tracked down Carr by phone in Nielsen's apartment. He could barely speak, Cameron recalled. She asked what happened, and he said he didn't know. Oh, wait, she recalled him saying. "I see a half-eaten ham sandwich on the nightstand. That's good. You tell everybody that she choked on a ham sandwich. Do you understand me?" "And I did it," she added, "because I wanted to protect Cass." What was she protecting her from? "I was not aware of a lot of drugs," she said. "I just wasn't one of those people. And I had some suspicion around the time that she was going to London that she was on some sort of pills, but I didn't really know anything." In a split second, Carr and Cameron decided that there was less shame in a woman ridiculed for her weight choking to death than there was in her having a drug problem. "What a terrible thing," Cameron said, "but I was in too much of a state of shock to clean it up." She, too, is confounded by the story's persistence. "Of all of the things I've done," she said, "this ham sandwich has followed me my entire life." That story has long haunted Elliot Kugel, too, though she felt some closure after Cameron privately divulged its origins to her when they met for lunch in 2000. Elliot Kugel is clear-eyed about what probably caused her mother's death. "I mean, look, she was up for 48 hours, and she was at a party, do the math." But she doesn't want to dwell on that. "The thing that was really important for me was that I didn't want to write a salacious book," she said. In some sense, any memoir by a child of the Mamas and Papas exists in the shadow of Mackenzie Phillips' 2009 bombshell, High on Arrival, in which she accused her father, John Phillips, of sexual assault. But Elliot Kugel's memoir belongs on a different shelf entirely. It is a humanizing portrait of a woman whose legacy has, for far too long, been reduced to an outdated urban legend. And it is a tale of an imperfect mother and a grieving daughter, of loss and long-delayed catharsis. A few weeks before we spoke, Elliot Kugel went to visit her mother's grave. "It's always weird when I go there because I never know what to say," she said. But that day felt a little different because when I went up to the grave, I just said, "Hi," like the way I would greet one of my cousins or somebody who I know really well who I haven't seen in a while. I thought to myself, why does it feel like this?" she said. All at once, it dawned on her. After going through this experience, I feel closer to her. Well, we are just about out of time. It looks like I only have a minute or so left, so that's not enough time to start a new article, so we will stop here for today. We will pick up with an article I wanted to read. The Chevy Malibu was so uncool, it was cool. So we'll save that for next time. Thanks for joining me as I read from the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times for Sunday, May 12th, 2024. Until next time, this is Tracy Shoster. Thanks, everyone, and have a great day today.